If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Welcome, everybody, to Dragon Quest FM. My name's Austin.
And my name is BJ.
And this week's episode, we're talking all about Dragon Quest and religion.
Ooh, I don't know why I made the spooky noise. that's not what we're like. Ah, that's better.
yeah. So, Dragon Quest games, religion figures into all of these games, at least in some way. And so in today's episode, we just thought we would kind of talk about the way religion plays differently in all of the mainline games, but also kind of Yuji Horii's thoughts on religion and Dragon Quest and all that good stuff, too.
Yeah.
We probably should start with the first games in the series, like DQ1, 2, and 3. These are not especially religious. They're more just kind of tales about good and evil. Even though there's churches that kind of have like a Catholic medieval house of worship vibe, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, really. And they don't really like play in very much. They're just kind of there, but it fits the medieval kind of atmosphere and world that they've built.
Yeah. And even in those first few games, you know, you don't really go to churches to save your games the way you do in the later entries. And so it's kind of like the churches are set dressing, I guess, to have the whole medieval town vibe going for it, right?
Now, I can't remember. It's been a while since I actually had to do it, but I know in 2 and 3, you have to get resurrected at churches. Do you have to do that in 1? No, there's not party members, so you just restart. Never mind. That answered my own question.
Yeah, you do use them for resurrection, and also, you know, priest becomes a playable class and character in Dragon Quest III. So we have to at least mention that, is that the kind of the church, I guess, becomes more important in that you can actually play as a priest and run around and heal people.
Which I love. I love that class. Like, the priest is one of my absolute favorite classes in all the games. I always have a priest in my party whenever possible until I have to upgrade them.
Oh, you don't like the upgrading, like the sages and all that kind of stuff?
I like them, but I actually like the priest, like, in terms of the look and everything better. I always upgrade them to a sage or whatever when I can, because they're ridiculously powerful. But I like the priest better.
Yeah. And Kirill, who's probably the most famous priest of them all, is pretty good. I mean, we both talked about him a lot in our Dragon Quest IV episodes because we liked him as a character and a priest.
Yep.
I'm more partial to sage myself than priest. Just because Sage usually gets better healing spells and more powerful, like, offensive magic.
Yeah, they do.
So then, starting in Dragon Quest IV, right, is the first one where you actually confess in a church?
I think so, yeah. I think IV is the one where you don't have to find a king, and you can go in and confess your... it's always funny to me, because you're confessing your sins for this, basically. You're confessing everything you've done, and they save for it. Like, I love it, but I think it's in IV is the first one you do that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think...
Because in 3, I've been playing it on the Switch, and I automatically went to a church, and I didn't have the option to save. It was just to resurrect and purify, so I just started using the quick save. I mean, I don't care that much about the adventure log, because I can quick save, so that's actually why I think that it's 4.
Yeah, so I looked it up, and it's starting with 4. I just wanted to double-check ourselves, because I was kind of in a similar way. When I was playing the mobile games of 1, 2, and 3, I used the autosave function so much that it kind of cuts out your need to visit a church or the king.
Yeah, it does. And it's so nice. Like, I really wish that Dragon Quest, of all of them, like, of all RPG series, I really wish that you could save anywhere you wanted to, because having to do it at a church is honestly very annoying when you're playing some of the later games, like 11. where I want to save. And I mean, you get campsites too, but I mean, like in dungeons and things.
And 11 thankfully has autosave. So, I mean, there are some definitely quality of life improvements to make 11 feel more modern.
Yeah.
I also just wanted to mention, I know we have it here in our notes too, is about the whole confess aspect of Dragon Quest games is pretty interesting because, you know, you go and you confess to like a nun or a priest or somebody all that you've done, almost like you're confessing your sins or something. And it's a nice play on, it's a nice play on words, but it almost kind of has like some subtext there, you know, with
saying it almost has subtext. I think it is straight up there. And what it is I love that you're confessing your sins and you're writing these adventures down and everything that you've done, good and bad, along the way. It kind of reminds me of the East games, since they're all like retellings of Adol's travel logs that he wrote down. And, you know, all this stuff happened in the past to him. And so that kind of, I like that feeling about Dragon Quest too, that you're going through this and you have the church recording your adventures and everything that you've done along the way for posterity. Like, that's what these adventure logs are, more than just being a game mechanic, that they play into the things that you're doing and the action that you're taking.
Yeah, and I always like, I like when games do that kind of thing where saving is kind of like an extension of the world itself.
Yeah.
You know, like you go to a church, you confess all that you've done to the church, and they're writing it down and saving it for you. Kind of like in one of my favorite saves is like the Moogles that save for you in Final Fantasy IX.
Yeah.
Where you talk to them and, you know, they open their book and they fly up with their little quill and they write it down for you with everything you've done. And I like games that do that, where it's just kind of an extension of world building instead of just like, you know, standing inside of a question mark that's lit up, like in Final Fantasy VII, for instance.
I think they do that in Trials of Mana as well. I can't remember. But I know you can save at like statues, at goddess statues, but I can't remember if they actually say anything in the remake about it being like you confessing, or that the goddess's light is shining down on you or anything like that. But I know that's how you do it. Like, I like stuff like that too, more than just the question mark that you walk into. Tales of Vesperia does it kind of, that they have the notebook that you're writing everything down in, and all the save points are these giant magical floating books in a sphere. Mm-hmm. Same for the Trails games. I mean, everything is recorded in your notebook. When you save, it's got your journey and synopsis and everything. So it's something that always just I notice, and it makes me happy whenever it's something that's not just a shiny spot on the ground.
Yeah, it's not all in Dragon Quest games. It's not all bright, happy, going to churches kind of stuff, because there's definitely like the bad guys in Dragon Quest games. Okay, like the first one had Dragon Lord, which kind of goes along with Dragon Quest. Mm-hmm. But then after that, Dragon Lords kind of give way to like Demon Lords, and Demon Lords give way to Lords of the Underworld, and that gives way to like Lord of Hell. And yep. So there's definitely a general progression here. like at some point, it's just going to be Satan.
Yeah, I mean, you fight what is essentially you always fight the Lord of Hell. So, I mean, it's kind of Satan anyway. But like even the big demons, even the big enemies at the end are archdemons and things like that, where it's straight up out of like religious terminology. I'm not sure how it is in Japanese, like what they're actually called, like what the translation is. But I know in English, they definitely have a religious connotation to them. Mm-hmm. And like, it's weird that some games, it's like they changed it like for censorship. Like, that's one of the things that makes me curious about how this is in like China and other areas in the world. Because like World of Warcraft, they had to change things from hell, H-E-L-L, to fell, F-E-L, really early on in the game for censorship reasons. It was easier for localization and stuff like that to have like fellfire rather than hellfire to worry about. And like just different things. Like, I know they actually, I think at that point they changed like some of the hellfire to fellfire to green to accommodate it too. Like, it's just an interesting change for some censorship and just world building too. I mean, it's when you do something like that, it's also to establish a fantasy world, but it's not uncommon to have to change it from like Lords of Hell. So it's interesting to me that Dragon Lord became Demon Lord and stuff like that in the US, at least, that it doesn't usually transfer into the more religiously connotative, or however you would say it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, and Dragon Lord doesn't literally become Demon Lord. I mean, he's Dragon Lord.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I was just kind of clarifying what you said there. But
like just introducing those kinds of villains as opposed to continuing with like Dragon Lord, Dragon Knight, that kind of thing.
Which is really like, weird that World of Warcraft would change that, because I mean, there's so many JRPGs that I played that came out way before WoW did that had no problem having hell and stuff like that in it.
Yeah, there were things like I remember specifically in Upper Blackrock Spire, there was an item called the Hellraiser that you got from one of the mini bosses in the dungeon, and one of the patches specifically called it out that Hellraiser had become Fellraiser, and that they had done a sweeping change from language across there and through like warlock spells and stuff. Where even though they're demons and they're still called demons, they actually took the word hell out of stuff. It was one of those changes that I'm pretty sure they said was for censorship reasons in other areas, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, weird. So DQ7, 8, and 9 are all especially religious focused. So we're kind of going to be focusing on a lot of those in this episode because you and I have talked about this. I mentioned it on my blog at one point is kind of a flyaway comment. And then I think you brought it back up again in one of the earlier episodes we did.
Yep.
Is that because of the way 7, 8, and 9 are so religious, we're like, why aren't 7, 8, and 9 known as like the Almighty trilogy, right? Because you have the Almighty in 7, you have the Almighty in 9, and in DQ 8, it's not necessarily as much about heaven and God the way that 7 and 9 are. But the church plays such a huge part of the main plot. You know, it's almost like the Vatican and all of this kind of stuff that plays into the plot of Dragon Quest VIII. And so all of that seems to tie together in a nice religious bow, the way 4, 5, and 6, let's say, kind of tie back to Zenithia, or 1, 2, and 3 tie back to Erdrick. It seems like 7, 8, and 9 have a lot more in common than a lot of people talk about.
It's not really talked about. It's like when I first started getting into the trilogy, or when I first started getting into Dragon Quest in general, I was seeing a lot of stuff about how it was broken into trilogies, and you know, you have the Erdrick trilogy and the Zenithia trilogy, and then everything that I was seeing was like, and then there's 7, 8, and 9, which are just kind of standalone games, and then you have 10 that's the MMO, and 11 is just come out. And I was like, okay, it's weird they didn't do a trilogy thing with them if they did it with the first 6, but I didn't think anything about it. And then you and I talked about it on here, and it's like, yeah, and after playing them, it's like, yeah, that's what they're focused on. Like, that's the unifying factor here, is that you're fighting God in DQ7. You are an angel who has been fighting like fallen angels and dealing with the Almighty directly in 9. 8 is dealing with the church and corruption and things like that. So it's like, these are most certainly a religious trilogy, but nobody talks about it.
And especially, you know, like 9 has the Celestrians. They're the little people with wings, which are basically just reskins of the Cirrus, who are the angel people in DQ7, who are basically just the Zenithians.
Yes.
And
I mean, that's normal for DQ to reskin things use them. I mean, that's great. That's one of the things we love about it. But absolutely, yes. Where they actually tie in with the Almighty in this one, as opposed to like the Zenith Dragon.
Yeah, where it's not maybe a unifying location like Zenithia, and it's maybe not a unifying hero like Erdrick, but it does feel like there's definitely some connections here. And you know, DQ9 and is kind of more like heavenly, celestial, deals with cosmic stuff. DQ8 is more about, you know, the church here on earth and kind of the more human aspect of religion. And DQ7 is kind of like a bridge between those two, because it deals a lot with the kind of the human aspect of it. But then it also, especially late in the game, turns into like a much more like cosmic, heavenly, mm-hmm. you know, celestial thing. So you start off with, you know, Goddess Rubis in the earlier games. You have a goddess that is kind of seen as like the deity figure here in the earlier games. And then that kind of transitions over to more of like a male deity. You have, so DQ7, I know you mentioned this, but you can literally fight God in DQ7. The Almighty, he shows up, and I mean, he's God, so it's like a friendly, it's a friendly battle. But you do have the option of doing that. You know, it's a bonus dungeon in the post game. You go up, you can talk to him, and you can, and you know, fight him if you want to walk up and be like, "Hey, God, let's fight." And if you can do it in 20 turns, I think it is.
Yeah,
it's when you get a reward.
Okay, I haven't gotten there yet in DQ7, so I haven't gotten to the post game.
Oh yeah, it's extremely late in the game, and I haven't done it myself. It's just one of those things that I, like, picked up on, you know, over time, because I haven't done.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, I haven't done a whole lot with the post game of 7. But yeah, if you challenge the Almighty, and I think you have to beat him in 20 turns or less, you get a reward, and then he goes over to your monster island. What's it called? The Haven.
The Haven, yeah. The it's not Heavenly Haven, is it? It's,
I think it's just
Monster
called,
Haven.
I think it's just called Haven. I don't know, but anyway, yeah. He goes over there and will like hang out with you, and you get in the 3DS version. There's some changes to it. Like, I think you get like an extra fragment that goes into some of the like 3DS post game. I don't know. I have not explored the post game of 7. To the extent that I have explored the post games of a lot of these other Dragon Quest games.
Right. Even though you've beaten it twice now, you just haven't done the post game stuff.
Well, the first time it was because I didn't like 7 very much. The second time it was because I wanted to replay it and ended up liking it a lot, but there was just so many other games I was playing at the same time. And with 7, I was just kind of chipping away at it. And so I may go back and do the post game. I'll probably use my first save because I definitely... did a whole lot more like grindy stuff and getting vocations higher on my first playthrough than I did in the second one. Cause the second one, it was like, I knew what to expect. So I didn't put as much emphasis on trying to grind up vocations. And, you know, I didn't experiment as much with like monster vocations and things like that.
Yeah.
So
one of the things that I always appreciate about these kind of games, about Dragon Quest and others that actually take on religion like this, is that they, like, okay, so religion and fantasy, a lot of fantasy novels is usually approached in a very negative light, that it's always like this, the corruption in the church, or there are zealots that are trying to do something, and DQ doesn't really approach it that way. One of the things that I've noticed in DQ 7, 8, and 9 is that it's not approached as though religion and God are always bad. Like, one of the things that I love the Xeno games, especially like Xenogears and Xenosaga, but one of the things about it is that God is a destroyer. Like, that's something that always comes in there. Like, in Xenogears, you end up fighting and defeating God because, you know, destroying things and wiping out humanity and other planets. And in DQ, like, that's not really the case. Like, it's not this wrathful God, usually. You talk about corruption within the church sometimes, but even then, throughout the games, you'll run into priests and nuns and just everywhere along, and they're nice people trying to help you out, as opposed to being one of these fantasy tropes. And I think that's one of my favorite things. Like, I'm not terribly religious or anything myself, but I grew up that way. And so when I notice something like this, where it's not being putting the church and deity as a villain, it really stands out to me, because it's so normal for it to be evil. And even like you said, when you go into a DQ7, it's like, God's not the bad guy. It's like, hey guys, you want to fight God? It's like, hey, you want to come live at my monster farm? It's not a like, oh no, you're gonna put the world into darkness because you have fallen somehow. It's like, nah, you want to come take care of my sheep? it's a much nicer take on it than usually happens in fantasy.
Yeah, and even Dragon Quest VIII, which deals with some of the corruption of the church and stuff like that, it's not like, let's say, Final Fantasy X, which is all that the church has completely been founded on a lie and is
right
and functions to suppress people. It's that in Dragon Quest VIII, it's that the church, there is just some like individual human corruption within the church.
Yeah, it's not the institution itself, it's the people who make it up, which is one of the, like I said, that's the reason I like the Dragon Quest take on it. The whole Final Fantasy X thing, where it's the entire basis of it, is it does fall into that trope.
While you were talking kind of more about this, I know we're towards the end of the episode, we're going to get into like Yuji Horii's thoughts on religion and Dragon Quest and all, but I did want to mention that, you know, Yuji Horii, this is a quote from him. He said that that religion is more of a lighthearted addition to Dragon Quest games. It's more to generate an atmosphere. In the world of Dragon Quest, there's no specific religion that it associates with in any way, shape, or form, whether it's Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, whatever it may be. The world is just protected by this overarching entity. So for Yuji Horii, it seems like he doesn't associate it with anything. And it is very obvious when you look at it that things are pulled from all sorts of religions. You know, you have you have like rebirth and reincarnation and things like this that can come from like Buddhism, Hinduism. You have stuff that could be perceived as like Vatican and Catholic beliefs and everything. And then you also
Catholic.
Yeah, I was about to say Catholicism and Catholic, and it came out Catholic.
Okay, I was like, wait, that's one I've not heard.
Yeah, I was halfway through Catholicism and partially into Catholic, and it just came out Catholic.
Gotcha.
Which sounds like I'm choking on something, doesn't it?
Catholic. It's Gollum.
Yeah. Catholic. We hates it. Catholic.
It burns us.
Catholic. What's taters?
What's taters?
So anyway, but I like that Yuji Horii kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying in terms of that he sees it as more just, it's more lighthearted, even by his own admission, than it is in a lot of other JRPG series. So I think that's pretty interesting. We do have a lot more religion to talk about, but before we get into like DQ8 and 9 some more and even more Yuji Horii quotes, let's pause and have some shameless self-promotion.
Oh, we're shameless, oh, so shameless, shameless.
So I'm going to mention our Patreon page really quickly. You can find that at patreon.com/DragonQuestFM. You can help support our podcast. We will love you for it. We'll also send you a sticker for it. You can get all sorts of other goodies. And so be sure to check that out over on patreon.com/DragonQuestFM. Also wanted to mention really quickly for Community Spotlight is the Lauren Coe interview over at RPG Gamer. We're going to link to that here. Be sure to check that out. Elman Dean Todd, he got to interview her, which is super awesome, and I'm only slightly jealous of.
Yeah, just a little jealous.
He actually messaged the Dragon Quest FM Twitter account ahead of time, asking us if we had any questions that we would like to ask Lauren Coe, which was just super nice of him. So really quickly, thank you so much for approaching us with that. So BJ and I did submit a few questions. So be sure to read that interview and also try to guess which questions were mine and which questions were BJ's.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a little fun game. So maybe you'll be able to tell, maybe not. But either way, it's a good interview. It's really cool. Very thankful that we got to submit a couple of questions for that as well. So be sure to check that out over on RPG Gamer.
And over on the Geek to Geek Media side of things, our network, just wanted to really briefly mention that we're revamping the network Patreon. We're going to be doing an exclusive kind of video game magazine. We're working on that. There's a preview and sample of it up on the Patreon, and you can check that out at geektogeekmedia.com/Patreon.
Yeah, and it's different. It's different from the Dragon Quest FM Patreon. It's not supporting the podcast. It's more, think of it more as like a magazine subscription, basically.
Yes.
It's kind of very similar to like Nintendo Force, which we've mentioned on the show before. It's very similar to that kind of thing where it's essentially a monthly magazine subscription.
Yep. So, and this is the first month of it. So check it out.
So what's the first issue about?
It is remakes and remasters of games. We're going to be talking about Final Fantasy Remake, the Trials of Mana Remake. We have stuff for DuckTales and Super Mario remakes that we may be expecting this year. And it's kind of a storytelling. It's not quite a not a reviews kind of thing, but more of an essay about this kind of stuff. If you've ever read like boss fight books, it's kind of been inspired by that take on gaming.
It's kind of like features, reading like gaming features instead of
really
news. Yeah, and there's a Dragon Quest III article in there as well, right? A feature for Dragon Quest III?
Yes, Steve Whitcamp is going to be writing about Dragon Quest III and all the remakes of it. So that one will be fun for y'all.
Yeah, just wanted to bring that one up since it's a Dragon Quest podcast.
I knew I'd forgotten one, and of course it was that one.
So heading back over into our Dragon Quest and religion discussion, we talked about 8, corruption in the church, all of that kind of stuff. But then let's go to what is probably the most religious of all the Dragon Quest games, which is Dragon Quest IX. Dragon Quest IX, it's all about angels and heaven and the Almighty. And, I mean, it's literally about heaven.
Yeah, it literally is. Like, you start the game and you're training to be a guardian angel. Like, that is how everything starts with it. So, like, you can't get more religion into DQ, really, than this one.
We mentioned this, I believe, back when we were doing deep dives into Dragon Quest IX. So if you're interested in seeing more Dragon Quest IX kind of discussions, be sure to check out those deep dives that we did toward the end of last year. But that's Corvus. You know, Corvus is definitely this fallen angel, a Lucifer character. I mean, he's an angel, and then he falls from heaven and totally turns into this demonic figure that you have to defeat in order to beat the main story.
Yep, absolutely. It's he is one of the most engaging characters, though, for all of Dragon Quest to me. Like, I love him, and I like his model on in the game, too, when you're fighting him. Like, I like pretty much everything about Corvus.
Yeah, and I like him a lot, too. He's one of my favorite. He's probably my favorite villain after Sorrow. Sorrow is still my favorite villain in all of Dragon Quest, but Corvus is an extremely close second. I mean, Corvus just, his whole entire story just makes for a very interesting backstory, but it's also one that, for an angel, is especially human.
Right.
And I think a lot of people can relate to, you know?
And I think he is far more engaging than Sorrow. I know we talked about this during our deep dive of 4, but Sorrow doesn't come across as a character that I can sympathize with at all. So it's when I see Corvus, he's the one that really makes sense to me.
So what you're saying is you are really, you can really relate to Satan.
I can.
That's the takeaway. Like,
it's true. Like, you remember, I don't remember if you were in one of my classes when I tried to teach Paradise Lost. I had students who would not come to class because of the way that I described it, that Satan was a sympathetic character, and they refused to even be exposed to that idea. And so it's one of those things like, yeah, he is. He's a sympathetic character when you look at it through certain lenses.
Yeah.
Y'all go read Paradise Lost if you haven't.
Or don't, man. Ugh.
It's very hard to read, but the story, I think, is worth it.
Yeah,
I only taught it for one semester because it was very hard to get people to read because of that. But the narrative is there. You should totally experience it at least.
Yeah, maybe. Or just read the Spark Notes. And yeah, no offense to Milton, but it's not exactly the easiest thing to read. It's not some light reading, you know?
It's not.
It's not like, you know, kick up your feet on a Friday night and get into some Paradise Lost.
It's true. Like, that's very true.
So what does DQ say about morality? Talking about BJ relating to Satan here. what does DQ say about morality? I think personally, DQ tends to have very stark differences. There's a fine line between the good and the bad. And I think that's often illustrated by sometimes flat villains. You know, you have these good guys and then you have these bad guys who are just bad because they're supposed to be bad. And so I think in terms of just overall morality, I think Dragon Quest definitely draws a line in the sand and says, this is what is right and this is what is wrong. But I also believe that especially later entries, I feel like tend to have some gray areas. And I think Corvus is a good representation of that because yes, he's very much evil, but he's only evil because of bad things that humans did to him.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, even Sorrow is one of those villains like that, that you've talked about. Like his whole thing is not that he is evil. It's that he is protecting someone he loves.
Yeah. And Sorrow and Corvus, I mean, their kind of backstories really mirror in a lot of ways in that, you know, Sorrow, humans hurt his girlfriend, Ruby. Corvus, it was his girlfriend, Serena, right? I believe her name was Serena, just like the Dragon Quest XI character.
It's been a while since I've read that. I've played that one, so I don't remember.
I'm like 99% sure her name is Serena. So, you know, Sorrow has Ruby, Corvus has Serena, and then it's like those things, you know, human actions are really what kind of drove them to be evil in the first place. So I think there are some gray areas, but I think overall, Dragon Quest is fairly black and white with where they land on like morality and everything. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, most of the time it's a big bad guy who is a big bad guy and they're evil for the sake of being evil. And like they're talking about destroying the world because they need to destroy the world for some reason that they don't really talk about. And it's one of the things that Corvus and Sorrow and even spoilers in Dragon Quest XI, there are things that are going on that are more gray area there. And it makes it feel a lot better. It makes it feel a lot more realistic to play through, I think, than just dealing with these big bads, because I think the best villains are the ones that think they're the ones doing the right thing, that they aren't villains because they're evil. Like there are very few people in the world who are truly evil, who just want to hurt other people. There are very few people who just want to watch the world burn. And that's why I like villains like Corvus who think that they're doing the right thing here. Like they get turned onto this path, they might get warped, but in their own mind, they might still think they're the hero here.
Yeah. And also the best villains are the villains that you can kind of see a little bit of yourself in.
Right.
not saying that, you know, everyone is like inherently evil, but
you're right.
But you know, the best villains are the ones that you can kind of relate to a little bit. Even if you can't relate to Corvus because of, you know, humanity being so mean to his girlfriend, maybe Corvus's favorite food is ramen and your favorite food is ramen. So you're like, hey, I can relate to that guy.
Okay, so seriously, one of my favorite things, I think you hate it about it, but one of my favorite things about Final Fantasy XV is how much Gladiolus loved Cup Noodle. Like him loving Cup Noodle so much made my day because it was just super normal. Like I don't usually like product placement. I didn't care for the Coleman stuff at the campsite really, but him loving Cup Noodles, it was like, yeah, you know what? Ramen's good. And I like that he just had this thing. He's like, got excited when he saw Cup Noodles. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
So even if it's only Cup Noodles that kind of bond you, but I mean, Gladiolus isn't a bad guy. If that
I mean, he's not a bad guy or anything, but man, if Arden had just gone crazy over Cup Noodles, I would have loved it even more.
So let's go ahead and talk about Yuji Horii. What does he say about religion and everything in his games? Earlier, I read a little bit of a quote from him. That was from a Polygon article that we're totally going to link to in this.
Right.
In this show notes as well, because it's a really interesting interview and it goes all sorts of places. So it's very interesting. And religion, you know, is a very small part of this interview. But, you know, he did talk about some of the lightheartedness and how he doesn't see it necessarily representing any certain religion. I did think it was interesting in this interview, going back to kind of the very start of this whole episode, the idea of churches. Basically, in this interview, Yuji Horii just says, yeah, the reason we implemented churches is because it was getting kind of too difficult for the kings to be the save points in these games.
Ah, yeah.
And I mean, it's true. You know, the first Dragon Quest game has that one king. I mean, the world isn't super gigantic, but it's pretty gigantic to only have one save point in the entire game. From a developmental standpoint, it totally makes sense that, hey, you know, you need to find something that is more spread out in order to save. And so churches are an obvious answer to that, just because every major town would probably have a church, right? So you could totally just have a church there, whereas every major town probably doesn't have a king. So from that kind of standpoint, it totally makes sense. I thought it was interesting that originally other people involved with the development of the game were kind of like, well, why can't it just be the inn? Because an inn is another obvious choice, kind of like the mana games. I mean, you go to an inn and you can save in those. So, you know, that makes sense too. But then kind of, I guess, thematically, the whole idea of confession just kind of worked well with what they were going for. And so they kept it as a church. And it's been a church ever since.
And one of the cool things about this interview is that it's not just Yuji Horii, that the DQ11 game director, Takashi Ujikawa, was talking about the churches. And one of my favorite quotes in this entire thing, let me see if I can pull it up again now, if I can find where the churches things is, that one, where he's talking about confession. And he says, the whole act of confessing at a church, that's something that I admired. It made me want to try it myself. It was like getting a feel for a culture from somewhere far from where I lived. Also, it helped me build my imagination to a certain degree of what Western fantasy could be like. He said that a lot of children, when he was playing Dragon Quest, probably felt like they were tapping into and experiencing a different culture through Dragon Quest. So I think that's really neat that something like us as Western players look at it being like, yeah, there's a church in every town, especially like you and me being from the South, where the joke is that there's a church on every street corner. It's interesting to see how it's normal for us to have a Catholic church in every town, or, you know, 1,000 different Protestant churches in a block radius of each other. But it, for somebody like the games director of DQ11 growing up, that was something unique to this series that you see. Like, oh, that's a different culture. I get to do this. And like you said, that's even something, it made me want to try it myself. Like, I hope to do this. He went and confessed at a church just to do it, because I've never done that. Like, I just hope that he did.
But that is interesting that what we as Westerners kind of perceive as like an obvious everyday thing, it seems like a fantasy to Eastern players.
Yeah, which is, I don't remember if it was here or if it was on Geek to Geek that I had talked about it because of talking about RPGs so much. Someone on Discord, I believe, had linked a JRPG history thing, like a history of Dragon Quest and the JRPG from YouTube. It was a short video. One of the things that it talked about that I didn't know going in was just how important like Western RPGs were at the time to the creation of the JRPG as we know it now. Like Wizardry and Ultima getting imported is what Yuji Horii played that made him want to make his own version of this that became Dragon Quest. And so it was Western fantasy that inspired something that we now consider as being something from the East. It's just this weird, interesting circle of trying to play something from a different culture and really feel those kind of things through it.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think if you take like just exploring the history for a second, if you take, so you can kind of start with like Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, which leads you to Dungeons and Dragons, because I mean, those guys made Dungeons and Dragons because they wanted to play in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And then you take Dungeons and Dragons and lead it to like Ultima and Wizardry. And then you take that and lead it to Dragon Quest, which you then drive through every JRPG that's kind of come out since. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely like just a very clear timeline here for like fantasy. And I think it all kind of goes back to Western fantasy, but definitely Tolkien, who was, I mean, then was also inspired by like Norse mythology and everything. If you really want to take it back,
take it all the way back, you get into like Scandinavian myths and fairy tales.
Yeah. So there you go. I know we're almost out of time, but I did want to mention this just kind of here at the end of the episode while we're talking about Yuji Horii. This always stood out to me. I want to talk about the monument that Yuji Horii got in his honor. It's over in his hometown. You know, it's the sword. It's Erdrick's sword. It's Erdrick's shield. And there's a little slime there. It was the inspiration for the cover of my book, the Dragon Quest book, now on sale on Amazon.com.
Shameless.
But seriously, I mean, you know, it's a cool image. It's a cool looking monument. You and I have both talked about wanting to get out there and see it for ourselves. There's two different things about the monument that have always stood out to me. And one is that, you know, the kind of inscription, one of the inscriptions, I guess I should say, on the monument is a Yuji Horii quote, life is an RPG, so have fun, right?
Right.
Which I really, you know, you can put that on my gravestone too, because I think that's a really good sentiment. But it kind of goes hand in hand with that whole kind of Dragon Quest ideology that, and you know, Yuji Horii's kind of like pathos, I guess. Is it pathos or ethos?
I think it'd be ethos.
Yeah. After I said it, I was like, no, wait, that's ethos. So I think it kind of goes along with Yuji Horii's ethos here and kind of the lightheartedness and everything of it. But also the day that this monument was going up and Yuji Horii was there, I thought it was interesting that, you know, he talks about, you know, the sword and the shield and all being there, and about the slime, it was added there for luck. And he was quoted as saying, as kind of laughing and saying, but you can pray to whoever you want for the monument, you know, talking about people coming out for pilgrimages and stuff. And so, you know, that's something that I definitely can get behind, you know, that idea of just, it's not being representative of any religion, that people can just kind of pray to whoever they want.
Like, I really like that. It's just so, it's the same thing that makes me love the fandom in general. It's just that it's open and welcoming for no matter what you do. Like, whatever it is, whatever it means to you to go there and do this, that's just as valid as anybody else's. And that's the way, like, this fandom has been. Like, everyone's ideas and personalities are welcome, no matter if you've been here for since 1986 or from 2016 or 2020. Like, whatever it is, like, you're accepted and welcome as part of this and just as valid as anybody else.
Yeah. I like that. That's a good place, I think, for us to end for today on that kind of positivity. So thank you guys for listening to this week's episode. And remember, if you want to talk to us directly, we're on Twitter at DragonQuestFM. You can find us sometimes on Facebook at facebook.com/DragonQuestFM, Patreon at patreon.com/DragonQuestFM. And if you want to talk to me directly, you can do that. I am on Twitter at DragonQuestAustin, and be sure to read my Dragon Quest blog. You can find that at dragonquestaustin.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at Professor Beej. You can listen to my other podcast, the Geek to Geek podcast, at geektogeekcast.com. And if you would like to check out the rest of the cool Geek to Geek content that we all put together, you can check that out at geektogeekmedia.com. We also have a Discord and Slack where the links are on the main Geek to Geek media site. So check that out. Come join us, talk to us, and have fun.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.